Now, at the end of class last time, we discussed that it's a little hard to follow material in or out of the cell. That sometimes when you look at where material is, you can't tell whether it's going in or going out, and you can't tell where it went first and where it went second. And in order to get around that, you have to actually do some kind of labeling procedure. And that's what I wanted to talk about first today. And there are several issues here. One issue is what kind of label it is, whether it is continuous or pulse chase, and how you detect where the label is, which is, and this is a separate category, which is you sort of look in place or you fraction it. And the results on your handout show, in fact, both methods reported, both types of label reported by both methods. Now, as a beginning here, what we're going to discuss is if you were following material in, say, through endocytosis, if you were following LDL, say, what would you see? So, if you look at your handout, if you were to add, the trick here is that you add radioactive material or material which is labeled in some other way. It is fluorescent, it is radioactive, it has an enzyme attached that you can assay. One way or the other, you're going to be able to find out where it is. And you supply the material, and then you take samples at various times. So suppose the first way we do it is a continuous label. You just supply labeled stuff and you see what happens. So at time zero, all of your labeled stuff is outside the cell. Now, what's going to happen with time? Suppose that this is the first place that cells go to, that material goes to, and this is, say, the second. Now, if that's the way it is, if you wait a few minutes, where will your radioactive material be? It will go in to here. But you've added an awful lot of it, so there'll still be plenty outside. And now if you wait a few more minutes and take a sample, what will it look like? Where will your radioactivity be? Well, some of this material would have moved over to there, but more of the outside would have moved in. So the picture is going to look like our third picture there. And from that, you can see how the processing works. Now, one way to detect this is to look at the cell and see where the label is. If the label is radioactivity, the method you use is called autoradiography. The idea is that you take and you put a layer of emulsion, as in film, over the cells. And then you let them be exposed for a while, and then you develop the film. Where there is radioactive material, there will be emissions. They will hit the film. And when you develop the film, there will be dark spots in the film. So there will be dark exposed areas in the film at this point over here, at this point over here and here, and at this point over here, here, and here. Now, another way to get at this, so this is sort of a see-it-in-place cell biology method, but there's also the fractionation method or the grind-and-find biochemical method. So another procedure to find out where your radioactivity is to take the cells at each time point and break them open and fractionate into, say, nuclei, cytosol, this organelle, that organelle. You have separate test tubes with each part of the cell, and then you test each one for radioactivity or fluorescence or whatever. And the graph on the top is what you would get from that kind of result. If you were measuring amount of label with time in various parts of the cell, if you measured the amount, say, if you were following, say, labeled LDL, if you were to look, say, at coated vesicles, you'd see something like this. So this is your first curve. Now, then what if you look at uncoated vesicles? Well, first your LDL gets into coated vesicles, and then those vesicles get uncoated. So the uncoated vesicles get radioactive later, and so on. Now, why does it look like this? You get more and more label in coated vesicles. Why does it plateau? You reach a point where the amount coming in balances the amount going out, and so the amount at this point in the cell remains constant. Now, the final curve you have there, depending on what it represents, will or will not plateau. If all of your material ends up somewhere and just sits there, then this curve will just keep going up. If the material is degraded or removed, then there is no final resting place, and every curve will look like this. Now, for example, LDL normally goes to lysosomes, and most of it is degraded. But if you have a lysosomal disorder and you're lacking the enzymes needed to degrade LDL, then the lipid is just going to pile up in the lysosomes like this. Now, this is what we call a continuous label. You're continuously supplying new stuff from the outside. The alternative, which is shown in the next panel, is what's called a pulse chase. So that's this one. So I guess I'll draw it over here. Now the idea here is you add some radioactive or labeled material for a little while, and then you wash it away and add unlabeled, ordinary material. And again, you take samples at increasing times. So at time zero, it looks like this. Now, after a few minutes, what has happened to this material? It has moved in. But now you wash away any material that didn't get inside and replace it with ordinary. So this would be unlabeled LDL. Now what happens next? Well, the labeled material moves on to the next spot. The unlabeled fills in, you can't see it or anything, and your picture would look like this. And those little open circles represent unlabeled stuff, which is invisible. So if you were looking for radioactivity or label, first it would be outside, then it would appear here, and then it would appear there. The difference is, notice, it disappears from here. Now, how do you think about a pulse label? It's a little like feeding a snake to a boa constrictor. You know, the bulge starts at this end, and then the bulge moves down, and then the bulge moves down, and the bulge moves down. A continuous label is like you feed in one mouse, and then you feed in another mouse, and another mouse, and another mouse, and you get a wave of mice going down the boa constrictor, which is, of course, not a practical matter. But in an experiment, you get a wave of radioactivity moving across the cell. Now, what if you did the fractionation routine? Instead of looking at the cells, suppose you fractionated and looked at each fraction, and those graphs are shown above on your handout. That in this case, what you would see, if you look at label with time, in various fractions, is more like this. Because coated vesicles would get labeled, but then the material would move on. The labeled material would move on, and with time, you wouldn't detect anything anymore in the labeled in the coated vesicles. But then you would start to see label in uncoated vesicles, and they would pick up, and then it would go away, etc. Now, the last curve is going to be, if the stuff builds up in the lysosomes, what would the last curve look like? Well, it's exactly like the one shown on your handout, that material would get into lysosomes, And then once all the material got into lysosomes, there isn't any more coming behind, but it just sits there. So it would look like this. Now that's, of course, not what normally happens. What normally happens is this material is degraded, broken up, and so the label would exit lysosomes as well, and in fact it would be diffuse all over the cell as the little pieces were broken up. Now, everything that I have said so far is about how you would label material going into the cell. But I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about how you would follow material going out of the cell. So before I do that, let me ask what questions there are. Yeah?
For autoradiography, could you also have it appear the label of things in white spots on a black background?
He's asking for autoradiography, could you make it come out so you had white on black or black on white? Probably you could, but the way it's normally done, you end up with black on white. Yeah?
Why the difference between coded and uncoded vesicles?
Why the difference between coded and uncoded vesicles? Well, if you go and you look back at your handout from last time about receptor-mediated endocytosis, you'll see that when things are endocytosed, they go first into coded vesicles and then to uncoded vesicles. And in fact, it's experiments like this that told us that, what I have on that handout is the way it works. Yeah?
How does the grind and find method fall under continuous?
How does the grind and mine? Well, grind and find is separate. Whether you detect your radioactivity, either, her question is, how does grind and find fall under continuous? We have two separate classifications here, the type of label and the way you detect it. So detecting it by in place, as you see this picture versus this picture. But if you did grind and find, for a continuous label, you'd see this sort of picture. And for a pulse label, this kind. So those are two separate things. How you do the label and then how you detect it afterwards. Okay, one more and then I'm going to go on. Yeah?
Did you use the continuous label method and the pH to label it? Would the plasma membrane just be like a straight line because you were constantly causing more and more?
Her question is, if you did a continuous label, what would the plasma membrane look like? Well, if you were to be dealing with something that bound to receptors that were on the plasma membrane, then the amount of stuff that was stuck to the plasma membrane would presumably go up very sharply and then plateau.
But what about the stuff that gets recycled?
We're not talking about following it all the way to the bitter end to the recycle part. Okay? We're just talking about looking at the first steps. Now, in this example. Now, how do you follow things out? One way is really very similar to this, in that if you want to follow what happens to a newly made protein, you could supply radioactive amino acids. And then what you would ask is, where do we first see radioactive protein, and where next, and so on. So you would supply labeled amino acids, that is, labeled precursors to whatever you wanted to follow. And then after a short amount of, when you take your samples at increasing time, when you take a sample and you either look at your sample by fractionating it or looking at the cells, you would wash off amino acids or precursors that are just lying around and hadn't been made into protein. They would be soluble and small. Amino acids that had made into protein would be locked into big molecules and would not wash off. So we wash off unused amino acids and we leave radioactive protein. Well, what happens if you do an experiment like that? What if you provide, say, radioactive amino acids, and you look at a secreted protein? I think in the first example where this was done, it was cells that secreted pancreatic enzymes. And the curves actually look exactly the same as this, except that they get labeled differently. So that if you do a pulse chase label, and remember, you've added radioactive amino acids. So what is the first place in the cell to have radioactive protein? It turns out to be the rough ER. So the rough ER would be this one. And the Golgi would be this one. Because remember, this time we're following something out. Before, we were following something in. And now you would then see secretory vesicles, that is, vesicles containing your made protein, and they would fuse with the plasma membrane, and the stuff, what would happen outside? So if we were doing a pulse label, in fact, this is what would happen outside. All the amino acids that I added are made into protein. The protein was made on the rough ER. From there, it must be shipped to the Golgi. From there, it's put inside a vesicle. From there, it's shipped to the plasma membrane. The plasma membrane fuses with the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane and empties its contents outside. And this, in fact, is how we know that secreted proteins are made on the rough ER and follow this path out. What if you did a continuous label? Then you'd see something like this also. But it would be rough ER, Golgi, etc. Now there is one other way which is commonly used to label and follow new proteins. And we've referred to it before, and it's in some of your problems, but I want to talk about it briefly, and that's the use of GFP, which stands for green fluorescent protein. And if you look at some of the pictures to which there are links in the notes, you will actually see some green organisms because they are making this protein all over. Now, green fluorescent protein is made normally by a jellyfish. And this is a small protein, and when you shine light on it, it fluoresces. So you can find out easily where it is in the cell. Now, I just realized that I think the projector is on, and we might as well save the bulb. And of course, that turned off the mic, I think. But I think it'll be all right. Wait till it has to recover. When the system recovers, I think I can turn the mic back on. But I wanted to turn off the projector. So green fluorescent protein is this very small protein. And what you do is you don't add the protein to the cells. This is a case where you have to use genetic engineering. Suppose you want to follow an enzyme around the cell, and this is the gene for the enzyme. By genetic engineering, you add the DNA that codes for green fluorescent protein either here or here. So you have a recombinant gene. So I'll draw that. Let's say we did it this way. And you fix it so this is read as a single messenger RNA and made into a single protein. Now what happens is the protein usually folds up. Something like that. That is, the part of the protein that normally folds in a certain way usually folds the way it's supposed to and does whatever it's supposed to do. The green fluorescent part folds up also separately as a separate domain. And if you shine light, it's like a little light bulb on the back end of your protein, or the front end, depending on how you did it. Now, the point is that this protein will go wherever it's supposed to go in the cell. And it will do whatever it is supposed to do. But it carries with it this fluorescent tag. So you can find it in the cell. Aha. That automatically turned down the mic. Okay, so that's too high. How's that? Is that about right? Okay. Yeah?
Is this how they made the fluorescent mice?
Is this how they made the fluorescent mice? Yes. And some artist made a fluorescent rabbit. But the real point of it is to make individual proteins in a cell fluorescent so you can see where they go, what they do, where they build up, and how they manage. And I can't resist mentioning that one of the inventors of this technique is Marty Chalfie, who was the chair of our department, is a senior biologist here, and who received the Nobel Prize for his work. This, many Nobel Prizes turn out to be for methods which are then very, very widely used, such as PCR, GFP, etc. So this is a very common technique, but it requires genetic engineering to get the cell to make its own tag protein, which you can now follow around. And there are some examples of this in the problems, and you will meet many more as we go along or as you read anything. Now, are there any more questions about any of this? Yeah.
So when you insert GFP, does it have to go into exon, like regarding like the part of the gene? Because that has to go into the transcribed part, right?
Well, remember, he says it has to go, the thing you add has to go into the transcribed part. Well, remember that introns and exons are both transcribed. So what you've essentially done is added another exon. Yeah. Why GF green fluorescent protein instead of yellow fluorescent protein? The answer is that the algae, the normal form that was discovered in nature is green. Now, people figured out that if you change a few amino acids in the protein, it will light up, it will emit light at a different wavelength and be a different color. So now there is yellow fluorescent protein, green fluorescent protein, blue fluorescent protein, etc. So what you can do is fix it so that one cell, one protein in the cell has a green tail and one protein in the cell has a yellow tail, and you can follow both in the same cell. Okay. Yeah.
Does this always work, or are there some proteins where GFP will interfere with
the function? His question is, does it always work? It almost always works, but there are occasionally cases where adding this little bit causes the protein to misfold and it doesn't work as well. But most of the time it works because the protein is fairly small and folds into its own domain. Now, I should say that in terms of exam one, this material is on it, but the rest is not. That does not mean you can go to sleep, but you can perhaps relax a little bit. Okay. Now, using all of these labeling techniques, we have followed things in, and that's how we figured out about how endocytosis works, and we've also followed things out and figured out how secretion works. How do proteins get to the outside, for example? And I want to summarize now for you, let's look at an overview of how does a protein get to the right place. Some proteins end up secreted outside. Some proteins stay inside. Some are in the cytoplasm, some are in the Golgi. How is that all arranged? Now, let me just say at the beginning that all the proteins are made inside cells. But once they're made, some are extruded or secreted into the outside, and some are not. Some end up as part of the endomembrane system, and some do not. Now, this is summarized on the top of 7A. How does a cell know where to send a protein? And that depends, know is in quotes, on the protein itself. That proteins are ribosomes attached to messages, and they start making protein. The ribosome message combination is the same to start with, no matter what protein it is. But now, these ribosomes can either stay in the cytoplasm, make their protein, and release it into the cytoplasm. And you notice that's what you have here on the right. Now, ribosomes, of course, aren't free. They're attached to message, but the whole shebang isn't attached to anything. And when the protein is finished, it will just be released into the cytoplasm. But the alternative is that this ribosome and message, and it's really a polyribosome with many ribosomes, the whole shebang will attach to the outside of the ER. In which case, you will have the rough ER, because what makes the rough ER rough is these attached ribosomes. Now, what determines what's going to happen to this ribosome that is making this protein? You notice here we have a short piece, incomplete piece, which is often called a nascent protein. Means the sort of newly born beginning protein. And it all depends on that protein itself, what is going to happen. Proteins have within them short sequences which determine where they will go. And these are usually called localization signals or localization sequences or LSs. These are the address, so to speak. If a protein doesn't have one, it stays where it is. The ribosome stays in the cytoplasm, and the protein is released into the cytoplasm. Now, we're talking about what is sometimes called the cytosol, meaning the part of the cytoplasm excluding the organelles, the part that's outside the organelles. But if the protein has a localization signal of the right kind that says, quote unquote, take me to the ER, if it has the right kind of localization signal, it will attach to the ER. And that kind of localization signal is usually called a signal peptide. So the big divide, really, is whether you have a signal peptide and whether you don't. Now, as it turns out, these proteins can have localization signals, but they don't have signal peptides. Because once they're made in the cytosol, where are they going to go? These can either stay in the cytosol, or they can be imported into nuclei, mitochondria, peroxisomes, all that stuff that is not part of the endomembrane system. So, as you see right here, they can go into mito or chloro, they can go into nuclei, or they can go in peroxisomes. Or they can just stay where they are, in the cytosol. They stay in the cytosol if they have no localization signal at all. If they have a take me to a peroxisome or a peroxisomal localization signal, they go there. If they have a nuclear entry signal, they go there. The signal to enter a nucleus is usually called an NLS, to enter a peroxisome, a PLS, and the mitochondria one has several names. But what about the endomembrane system and secreted proteins? Remember we said, we know from our labeling experiment that secreted proteins enter the ER, go to the Golgi, etc. So what happens to these proteins is that they, as they are made, they enter the ER. Now what we mean by that is, here's a little bit of ER. This is a membrane, a bilayer. And here's our ribosome, and it's making protein. What we're saying is that the protein enters as it is made. It wiggles in, and this is called co-translational import. Apparently, the energy required to link amino acids together provides enough energy to move the chain across the membrane through a pore, as we will explain, into the ER. Now, these proteins, if they're going to get into mitochondria, nuclei, or peroxisomes, also have to wiggle through some kind of pore or hole, but they do it after they're made. So that's called post-translational import. They're made first, and then they go where they're supposed to go afterwards. But proteins in humans that get into the ER get in as they're made. In yeast, they may get in later, but not in humans. Now, when we say a protein gets into the ER, what does that mean? You notice here there are two possibilities in the ER membrane or in the ER lumen. Now remember, lots of different things are called lumen. It means the space in the whatchamacallit. So the space in the ER is the ER lumen, the space in your intestine is the intestinal lumen, etc. Now what we mean is the protein could go only this far and fold up and be a transmembrane protein. Or the protein could go all the way in and be a soluble protein inside the ER. And we will return later, probably around lecture 12, and explain how the protein gets across and why some stop and some finish the job. But for now, you just have to take my word for it that some proteins do one, some do the other, and it depends entirely on the sequence amino acids of the protein itself. If the protein has the appropriate sequence, it will lodge in the membrane as a single or multipass. If the protein has a different sequence, it will end up inside. But now, how do you get from the ER to the Golgi? Well, vesicles are going to butt off, and then they're going to go to the Golgi, and they're going to fuse. And we've discussed many times how vesicles forming and fusing can move things around. Now, if the material was inside the lumen of the ER, where will it be in the vesicle? It will be inside the lumen of the vesicle. And when that vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, with the Golgi, it will be inside the Golgi. On the other hand, what if the protein were in the membrane? Well, it would travel always in a membrane. It would be in the membrane here, it would be in the membrane here, and it would be in the membrane here. And it is worth convincing yourself by drawing it out that what starts in the cytoplasm, as we say, stays in the cytoplasm, that this part here will be on the outside of the vesicle and the outside of the Golgi. But if you may remember, for secreted proteins, they go to secretory vesicles and they go outside. So proteins can in fact stay in the ER, or they can stay in the Golgi, or they can be vesicles that bud off the Golgi. And then the protein can either be inside or transmembrane. Now, some of these proteins really belong in the ER. They have to go through the Golgi to get some modifications. So we should put Golgi here. But then they're sent back to the ER or sent back to the early part of the Golgi or whatever. So from here, it can go to any part of the EMS. Because we know when a vesicle fuses with a target compartment, it delivers the goods. If there was something in the lumen, it ends up in the lumen. If there was something in the membrane, it ends up in the membrane. But in some ways, the most interesting case is how do proteins get secreted? How do they get outside the cell? Well, what's going to happen is this vesicle now, finally, is going to fuse with the plasma membrane. It says here, plasma membrane. Maybe we should enlarge what's going to happen. Here's the plasma membrane, and here's our vesicle. It's going to come up, and it's going to disgorge its contents. If we're talking about a secreted protein, the protein would have been inside, and it will end up outside. If we are talking about a membrane protein, when we finally open this up, our membrane protein that used to be in the membrane of the ER, went to the membrane of the Golgi, went to the membrane of a vesicle, is now part of the membrane of the plasma membrane. So this is how surface proteins reach their destination, and this is how secreted material exits the cell. Now, we've said several times that when the only parts of protein that have sugars attached to them are outside the cell. They are either the extracellular domains or they are secreted proteins. Well, the reason for that is the enzymes that add sugars are inside the ER and inside the Golgi. So only something that's gone through this side can possibly get glycosylated. And only the part that was inside the endomembrane system can get glycosylated. Now, you probably should notice that this picture is exactly the reverse of endocytosis. Endocytosis, you just do it backwards. The membrane invaginates, you form a vesicle, and it separates. Now, the thing I meant to do last time, but I forgot to bring it with me, actually is for endocytosis, but same idea. We keep saying that what was on the outside of the membrane is going to be inside the vesicle and vice versa. Now, I couldn't do it with a balloon, but you can do it with this. This is clearly outside, right? Let's have a little endocytosis. And it's pretty clear that what was on the outside is now lining the inside of the vesicle. And vice versa, what was on the inside of the vesicle is going to end up outside. And there's some neat pictures in that inner life of the cell which show things going sort of bloop and being released. So exo and endocytosis then, following things in, follow things out, are two sides of the same coin. Now, before I go on, let me ask, are there questions about this before we consider what good are secreted proteins anyway? Yeah? Oh, that one of the questions here is how do things get into the nucleus and the perinuclear space, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. Yeah?
Confused about localization signal versus a peptide signal. Are there two different sections?
A localization signal versus a peptide signal. All localizations are sequences of amino acids. But the specific one that says take me to the ER is usually called a signal peptide. So, sometimes that is used for all localization signals, but usually it's restricted to this. So when you look, yeah, go ahead.
So then we'll add like two signals on it if it's going somewhere else.
After. Good point that he made. If you're going to get outside this, if you're going to go fairly far, you have to have more than one signal. Because you have to have one signal that says, take me to the ER. But then once you get here, what's going to happen? If there is no additional signal, the protein is generally secreted. If there are additional signals, the protein will be taken, say, back to the early Golgi, back to the ER, etc. Yeah?
Here's one to double check. So if it's a single pass protein, if it goes all the way into the movement of the ER, and then it's a membrane protein, if it's a multipass?
You mean how do you get a multipass?
Well, I just want to make sure. Yeah.
Well, this picture does not explain how you get a multipass. Oh. And we will come back to that. A multipass does not go, it works in a slightly different way, but it ends up that way.
So that picture explaining this?
A multipass gets in by a variation of this scheme,
okay,
which we will explain, so I probably should have drawn this too.
Okay.
But exactly the mechanism of how you thread the protein in the membrane, we have not explained. Yeah.
With the co-translation report, did you say the protein needs a pore to get across the membrane? It just goes straight.
A protein, does the protein need a pore here to get across the membrane? It absolutely does. Remember, protein is lipophilic. It has that lipid layer. So there has to be like a hole in the membrane, some kind of channel or pore to thread the amino acids through. And we'll explain that too. Yeah.
What reads the signal once it's in the vesicle?
Say that again. What reads the signal once it's in a vesicle? Well, there are other proteins in here, and there are other proteins in here, and they presumably read the appropriate signals. We will talk about a couple of specific cases later, the ones that are the best known, of how you read signals.
I'm sorry, I'm a little hung up on the localized signal. I thought you said that is the code for the address. So then how is that different?
Okay, the localization signal is a general term, and a signal peptide is one of them. And perhaps what I should have said is the big deal is signal peptide or not determines this one. Then other localization signals determine what happens here and what happens here. So there are multiple localization signals of which the signal peptide is probably the most famous, but there are many. One more.
Would you say a secretory, protein is something like clathrin? I mean, for clathrin to be made?
Clathrin is a peripheral internal protein. So where do you make clathrin? Where is clathrin found? It's in the cytoplasm. So in fact, clathrin is one of these. It is not made in a vesicle. You had a question?
Yeah. Is the protein guided by the cytoskeleton or other proteins?
What guides the protein? You mean at this point? In some of these cases, the moving of vesicles or of proteins involves the cytoskeleton, and some it doesn't seem to. And we're just going to let that go for the moment. Now, if you find this interesting, this is what they talk about in cell biology, all the details. But we will talk about more in a little couple of lectures. Now, before I go on, I want to discuss what good are secreted proteins. We already know one major function of secreted proteins. And that is they're used to build the extracellular matrix. The basal lamina, the gel-like stuff, proteoglycans, adhesive proteins, collagen, all that stuff. All those proteins are secreted. But there is another class. There are two other classes of secreted proteins that are really important that I wanted to talk about. And one class are what are called exocrine secretions. There are actually three classes here. These are proteins that are extruded either to the outside of the body or to lumens inside. And they go through ducts, like your tear ducts, or through ducts from the pancreas to your stomach. And this includes enzymes, such as there are enzymes in your tears that help destroy bacteria. There are enzymes in your gut that help you digest what you eat, but they're made by cells and extruded. And it also includes things like breast milk, which is largely of nutritive value, but for somebody else, not for you. Now, there's a third category of thing, which is proteins that are secreted from the cell because they act as signals. And these are largely signal molecules that operate within the same organism. Now, what do you need signal molecules for? We talked about insulin, for example. Insulin is made by one cell type and tells another type to mobilize GLUT4 and do other things to use glucose. Well, you need signal molecules to run an organism. A multicellular organism has many parts that have to be coordinated. And molecules secreted by one cell type tell another cell type what to do. So that's one use. It's just you need these to run the organism, obviously. And they have another major function. They're needed to help you build the organism in the first place. Running an organism is what people usually call physiology, how you get your liver coordinated with your kidney, with your brain, etc. And there's also the issue of how you got built in the first place. So your hands ended up out here and your head ended up here and everything's the right size and so forth. So that's the issue of development or building an organism. So signal molecules are extensively used to put you in place and keep you going. And the question, they are often subdivided, not because there are, the molecules know about this, but because it's easier for us to keep track of them. And the various kinds are actually illustrated on 7B. And I think the easiest way to do this is just to start with number 2 and then we'll come back and do 1. I just want to make a little space here. Okay. Now, what is these? There are many ways to keep track of signal molecules. And one is by the kind of cell that makes it and where the target is. So the first case that's given here, I'll start with 2. Is you have a cell that makes it. So the cell makes some substance, which is usually, but not always, a protein. And then it goes into a vesicle and is released. So we probably should draw it in here in a vesicle if it's a protein. And then it travels to a receptor on another cell. Now, if our signal molecule is a protein, then the receptor must be in the membrane of the cell so that the receptor can, the ligand can bind to the receptor. Proteins cannot enter cells on their own. So the signal molecule has to bind to a receptor on the cell surface. Now, when the target is close by, and the cell that makes it, so this is where the target is, and the source of the signal molecule is an ordinary cell, this kind of signaling is called paracrine. Now, you've probably all heard of endocrine. Endocrine is case, oh, actually 1. I saw they weren't, I didn't realize they weren't in order. So this is 2. This is called paracrine. Now, endocrine, you probably all know about. That's what hormones do. What's the difference? You notice that the beginning looks sort of the same, that something is secreted from the source cell. But the difference is that the source here cell is a gland. And it's a special, this is called endocrine cell signaling. And the special cell that makes it is called an endocrine gland, like the special cells in the pancreas that make insulin. Now, the difference is that instead of having a close target, they have a target far away in the body. Now, how does a material get from one cell to its close neighbor? It has to pass through the interstitial fluid, but that distance isn't large, and it can probably just diffuse. But if you have to get a signal from the pancreas, say, to your fat cells, that could be quite a distance. So how is the protein going to get where it's supposed to go? The trick is that the protein goes into the a blood vessel. It travels through the blood. Remember, the cells lining the blood vesicles are not tightly joined, and proteins can enter blood vessels and exit them. And then it reaches a target cell somewhere else in the body. So the target cell is far away. The special signal molecule is made by a specialized cell, and this is called endocrine. Now, there's one more variation on this, which is number 3. And this is only one cell involved. Here, whatever the special molecule is, binds to a receptor on the same cell. Now, not all paracrines and endocrines, and these are called autocrines, are proteins. But many, many of them are proteins. Now, you know of an example, this is usually an ordinary cell. You know about endocrines already. A typical endocrine made of protein is insulin. Now, there are endocrines that are not made of protein, such as thyroid hormone, testosterone, etc., but a lot of them are proteins. You probably know about paracrines too, although you don't realize it. A lot of growth factors are paracrines. So, for example, we talked about EGF, epidermal growth factor. This is a protein secreted by one cell, binds to the next cell, and tells the next cell to grow. Now, an autocrine means that a cell stimulates itself. And this may sound sort of dumb, but this is used in the immune system. It means that the signal can only affect the cell if it comes from the outside. Now, in most cases like this, the signal comes from somebody else. But in this case, the cell makes the signal, releases it, binds to itself. Now, in a way, the most interesting example of autocrines are bad news. Many cancer cells started out as cells that were dependent on paracrines for growth factors. So the cell wouldn't grow unless it got a signal from its neighbor. But what happens if the cell starts making its own signal? Then you got trouble. And one kind of thing that causes cancer or uncontrolled growth is when a cell starts making its own growth factor and is not reliant on factors from the outside. Now, on your handout, you have a couple of other combinations. 4 and 5 involve nerves. And I don't want to talk about them very much now because most signals between nerves are not proteins. They are small molecules that are released from the end of one nerve cell and either just go to the next cell or go through the blood. But they're here for comparison. Now, you notice that 6 is exocrine. Most signaling involves signaling from one cell of the body to another. But some signaling involves from one person to another. Now, this is not thought to be that important in humans, but there is some evidence for it, that some of the exocrine secretions of one person can be sniffed by another person and create a signal. This is quite important in other mammals. That's how some organisms tell that their mates are at the right stage of fertility. That's probably not true for humans. But there are some experiments that indicate that humans can detect some exocrines from others, and it serves as a signal. Now, there are two other things on the top. While we're talking about ways that you can use protein from one cell to tell another cell what to do, we want to put those two in. Now, the one on the top is an example of gap junctions. Cells can be connected by gap junctions, and that allows signals to travel. Now, this is a little different. Where's the protein in this picture? Gap junctions are really too small for most proteins to go through. So the gap junction itself, the connexon, is made of protein. But most of the signaling here is done by small molecules traveling back and forth. But in a summary of signaling, this gets thrown in. Now, the final case is one where there is protein is actually the signal. But the difference is that the protein is never released. So it's not that you have a soluble protein released by one cell that travels to a receptor on another cell. Instead, both cells have surface proteins. And these two surface proteins connect to each other. And the signaling in this case can go in either or both directions. In this case, which is the ligand and which is the receptor is often arbitrary. Because actually, I'm kicking you and you're kicking me, and the signal is going both ways. Now, this is called juxtacrine. And this kind of signaling is quite important in development and in the immune system. A lot of the interactions in the immune system between the various cells involved in defense involve this kind of interaction. The two cells contact each other, and that triggers an event. Now, one of the things that was perhaps not made clear here, but is very important, is that every time a receptor and its ligand get it together, that causes a conformational change, as we've indicated before, in the cytoplasmic domain of the receptor. And this is what actually triggers some action in the cell and a response. And when we talk about signaling formally, we will explain some of the steps that take place once this protein domain changes conformation. How does that get anything to happen? So we're going to put that off, but we will return to it. Now, all the cases we're talking about here, a cell makes a protein. Of course, that protein would be in a vesicle. The vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, releases the protein. And in the cases of nerves, it isn't usually a protein, but it's a water-soluble small molecule. Now, if you have a water-soluble small molecule, where is its receptor, or big molecule, where is its receptor? Is the receptor inside? No. If my signal is water-soluble, my receptor has to be on the surface of the cell. But there are cases of signaling that involve lipid-soluble signals, as we, I think we've mentioned before. And if you have a lipid-soluble signal, where's the receptor? It's usually inside the target cell, because lipid-soluble molecules can pass membranes, and their receptors can be inside. But if you're talking about proteins, all the receptors have to be on the surface, as shown in this handout. Okay, so we've introduced this idea here because we're going to be talking as we go, and as you read, you will find these terms of exocrine, endocrine, paracrine, autocrine, etc., tossed around, and this is what they mean. Now, I thought I would tell you one example of the use of some of these things. A lot of these signal molecules are used in medicine for healing. Insulin, for example, is commonly used if you don't make your own. There are many other signal proteins that are used, and many of them are used by athletes for legitimate purposes when they have problems. But, of course, once you get something that helps, people tend to bootleg it. And so a lot of these things are famous because they are used and misused by athletes. There are hormones, for example, which cause you to make more red blood cells. They're a kind of growth factor, really, and they tell you to make more blood cells. And people have been known to take these illegally. The most famous of these is called EPO, for erythropoietin. The general problem is that since you make your own, if there's a little bit added, who would know? So there is an arms race between the athletes and the supervising agencies that detect these things. A thing that was very that's come into common use recently is for healing to use what is called PRP. Which is platelet-rich plasma. And I'll put a link to this in the notes. It isn't there now. Platelets are fragments of red blood cells that contain a lot of growth factors. And so in many cases of injury, what people do is they take platelet-rich plasma, which is a fraction of the blood enriched for platelets, otherwise known as a cocktail of growth factors, and they inject it into the site of injury. And the idea is that this will promote healing. And this is quite a legitimate use of it, although it is not entirely clear how useful it is. But if it has any chance of working, there are a lot of people who want to try it. And the question is whether, of course, this is being used to zoop people up in the first place. But this is a very interesting use of growth factors, and these are paracrines. These are compounds that are normally proteins normally made by these cells to stimulate their neighbors. Now, this is all I wanted to say for now about secreted proteins. And I wanted to go back into the cell and consider, if we look at this picture, we've talked a little bit about these proteins. Now we want to talk about the proteins that end up in nuclei. Now I'm going to put off how they get into mito and into peroxisomes. And I realize I should have added one thing here. When we say these proteins can go to any part of the endomembrane system, I said they could go back to the early Golgi, they could go back to the ER, of course they can go to vesicles, to the plasma membrane, but there's one very other important part that I left out. And that's lysosomes. That these materials can go either to endosomes to be sorted and ultimately to lysosomes where they will be used. Okay. So having said that now, what about getting into nuclei? If proteins are made in the cytoplasm, how do they get into nuclei? Now, the answer to that is partially shown by looking at your handout again. And for this one, you want to look at A, the bottom of A. If you take, this is a cross-section of a nucleus showing the famous nuclear envelope. In your picture goes like this. And this illustrates that the nuclear envelope is continuous with the ER, and the rough ER would be because the cytoplasm is out here, the cytoplasm or the cytosol. The nucleus, of course, is in here. This is a piece of the nuclear envelope. This is what is usually called the inner nuclear membrane, and to keep it straight, the outer nuclear membrane. And here we have what we've called the perinuclear space. And as someone mentioned earlier, the perinuclear space is continuous with the lumen of the ER. So proteins that belong here can be made on the ribosomes of the ER, on the rough ER, enter the ER, and end up in the perinuclear space. Now, how do the proteins of these membranes get here, transmembrane proteins? It's thought that they are made in the ER and travel laterally along the membrane until they reach their destination, and then they're locked into their destination by attachment to peripheral proteins on one side of the membrane. So we think that you can make proteins, transmembrane proteins here, and then they can laterally diffuse into both the outer nuclear membrane and the inner nuclear membrane. Now, there's one piece here, which I didn't add yet, which is a structure here. And this is called the nuclear pore complex. This is an extremely complex structure. Some people think it's the biggest protein complex in the cell. And this controls entry and exit into and out of the nucleus. Now, these structures are all called pores. And the nuclear membrane is completely covered with pores. There are some nice pictures on your hand, links on your notes, One is to a freeze fracture of the nuclear membrane, where you can see these pores. But if you look from the outside of, this is a nucleus now, not a cell. If you look from the outside of the nucleus, it would be covered with pores. Each of these is a pore. And there's a complicated protein structure in here. And there are pictures of that in your books, and there are links on your notes. Rather than show them on the slides, I've just linked them into your notes. Now, these structures are very complicated. And before we say anything else, we should just mention that small molecules are apparently able to diffuse passively through these as if they were channels. They go down their gradient in or out of the nucleus. But large molecules like proteins have to be actively transported across the membrane, across the envelope, or really two layers of membrane. Now, what is the structure of a nuclear pore? If you were to cut, say, through one of the pores to chop, what would you see? Usually you see a picture that looks like this. This is the nuclear envelope, a piece of it here. This is, let's say this is the nucleus side, this is the cytoplasm. Here the inner and outer membrane are fused, here they're fused at the pore, and there's proteins in here. I have always found this hard to understand, so I brought a three-dimensional model, my usual high-tech. One way to think about it is you have two membranes, right? Inner and outer membrane of the nucleus. And there are holes punched through it. It's like two doggy doors. Now, the trouble is, this won't stay open. And it has to be at least partially open all the time so small molecules can go through. So what happens, really, is that these membranes fuse. And so what it looks like is more like this. Where the membranes have fused all around the pore. And those pictures come from cutting it, doesn't matter, this way, this way, this way. When you cut it, you see this, and you see that. Now, I have a bigger one because it's a little hard to see. So this is our two fused membrane, and the periplasmic space would be in here. Here, let's say this is the nuclear side, this is the inner membrane, this is the outer membrane, and they're fused all around the pore. Now, what keeps the pore open? I kept the doggy door open with my hand. But there's actually a protein embedded in here. Guess what? Looks like this. Now, this is the one bagel model. Connexins are the two bagel model. We only have one protein here. And this protein, though, is very... I've only drawn one structure here. In a real cell, there is like a donut-shaped, torus-shaped protein here. And then there are other proteins that extend out this way and proteins that extend out this way. And in addition, there are transmembrane proteins that lock the whole structure in. So this is held in place by transmembrane proteins that go across. So if you cut this thing, what you see is what I showed you, but when you cut it, you also see the ends of the bagel. So the bagel is here, it's really back there, and you see the proteins that are holding it. And it's important to remember there are additional proteins going out this side and going out that side. So this is a very complicated structure. Now, the way it acts, the nuclear envelope actually forms is probably not by having two layers and punching a hole. It probably forms by vesicles fusing together, but the net result is the same. So now we want to look at how things get in and out of the nucleus. As we said, for small molecules, it's simply a matter of passive diffusion through the equivalent of a channel. But for proteins, it's different. For proteins, remember, proteins must get in And some proteins actually must, and mRNA must get out. So big things go in and big things go out. Now, in order to go in, the protein requires a transport signal, one of these localization signals. There is a signal that says, take me in, and a signal that says, take me out. We mentioned that before. There is a nuclear localization signal. That means take me to the nucleus. And there is a nuclear exit signal, which is used to get out. mRNA is presumably attached to proteins that have a nuclear exit signal. Otherwise, it would never get out of the nucleus. Now, what does that localization signal mean? Somebody asked, who reads the localization signal? There are proteins that act as a kind of middleman. They bind to proteins that have an NLS, and they bind to some piece of the pore. And in order for a protein to go in, the protein must bind to the middleman binds to the pore, and that allows an active transport process that involves the splitting of GTP. And we haven't gone into all the details. If you look in your books, they will tell you more. So now by an energy-requiring process, the protein goes inside and the middleman goes with it. So both the ferry protein and the actual cargo go in inside. And this protein is called important, for import in. Now, there is a very similar protein which serves the function of letting things go out. If things have a nuclear exit signal, then they bind to a different middleman protein, which binds to the pore, which triggers transport and the splitting of GTP, and the whole package goes out. Now, the ferry protein on the way in is called important, and the one on the way out is called export. Now, if you look at your picture, there is a feature here that we did not add. And that is, you notice that there's a sort of network here supporting the nuclear envelope, just as there is a spectrin web under the plasma membrane. And these are those famous proteins, the lamins, the intermediate filaments restricted to the nucleus. All other aspects of the cytoskeleton are in the cytoplasm. But this particular kind of filament, these intermediate filaments, are found in the nucleus. Now, I just want to say a word or two about the lamins, and then I'll leave the part about the nucleolus for next time. In order for this structure here is called a nuclear lamina or a nuclear cortex. It is sad but true that many different things are called a lamina, just as many different things are called a lumen. So a lamina just means a thin layer somewhere. So how is mitosis going to take place? You have to get the nuclear envelope out of the way. So what's going to happen is this material is going to break into vesicles. They're going to be pushed away. And then when mitosis is over, the vesicles will coalesce again to reconstitute the nuclear envelope. So what's going to happen to the lamins? During interphase, they're all linked together to form a network. But they're going to have to come apart during mitosis so that you can disassemble this whole thing and put it back together again. Now, what triggers the coming apart of these lamins is actually phosphorylation, the addition of a phosphate. There is an enzyme, a kinase, that is activated when cells enter mitosis that phosphorylates the lamins and many other proteins and causes them to take the form you need during mitosis. So how are we going to get it back together again? You have to take that phosphate off. So we have another enzyme, which is triggered when you end mitosis, which takes off the phosphate. It's a phosphatase. And these enzymes actually modify many different parts of the cell. Phosphorylation gets everybody ready for mitosis. Dephosphorylation gets everybody ready for back to interface. Now, we said there are kinases and phosphatases as part of the sodium-potassium pump. These are different. These are separate from their substrate, not part of it. These are separate enzymes which phosphorylate or dephosphorylate a whole bunch of things. So I'll end by asking you a question. Do lamins need a nuclear entry localization signal? Lamins are made in the cytoplasm, enter through these pores, and yes, they do. Do they need a nuclear exit signal? Well, they have to leave, but when they leave, everything falls apart anyway. Can we take off the nuclear localization signal? In many proteins, once it gets where it's supposed to go, you take off the localization signal. Can you take off the nuclear localization signal once this stuff gets in the nucleus? Well, think about what happens at mitosis. If you took it off after mitosis, they'd never find their way back. So in fact, they keep it. And we'll talk next time about the role of the nucleolus and the production of ribosomes.